You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Uncovering the history of the Christiansborg colonial fort in Ghana. Welcome to a special episode of Archaeological Context with Dr. Noah, where I want to highlight a bit of a different topic, as we will focus on a time period and especially geographical region not often featured in archaeological discussions. A 17th century UNESCO World Heritage Site located on the west coast of Africa. Specifically, we will explore Christiansborg Castle in Osu, a suburb of Accra, the capital of Ghana. I aim to cover the interesting and dark history as well as results of recent excavations. I am already sorry if my pronunciation of some places and names will be incorrect, but I think it is important to share this interesting research, and I had the pleasure to talk about this with Professor Fritz Beveridge from the University of Ghana. Here's already an extract of our conversation. Do you know more about this underground tunnel, where it leads to?
Yes, it's still there. It's closed now. I've not accessed it, but it was used to transfer slaves from the dungeons to slave ships, which were berthed ashore. You know, we didn't have a harbor, so they had to stay way back, and then canoes would take them to the ships.
Oh, yeah.
And as a security concern, it was easier to transfer through these tunnels.
The area of Osu and the Christiansborg Castle in particular have a very interesting history, of which I can only give you a brief summary here. Unfortunately, very little is so far known about human occupation around Osu in the times before the area was seized by the Europeans. The first were the Portuguese in 1550, which occupied this strategically well-situated location at the intersection of important inland and transatlantic trade routes. However, their influence diminished, and in 1652, the local king in Accra allowed the Swedes to construct a small fortified trading lodge. Some 8 years later, the area was bought by the Danish, or better, Danish-Norwegians, as both were under the rule of the king in Copenhagen, and the construction of the castle named after King Christian V began. Then, over almost 200 years and different phases of construction activities, the castle grew to contain a courtyard, cistern, chapel, storerooms, living quarters, and it was armed with some 28 cannons. From the 1660s to 1850, the Christiansborg Castle was the headquarters of Danish-Norwegian activities on the west coast of Africa. They traded guns, liquor, cloth, iron tools, or glass beads in exchange for gold and ivory. But especially during the 18th century, these activities were dominated by the horrendous transatlantic slave trade. And it is estimated that at least 100,000 people were forcibly taken from the areas administrated from Christiansborg and shipped across the Atlantic to the Danish West Indies in the Caribbean. Apparently, the castle played such a vital role in the Danish economy that from 1688 to 1747, Danish coinage even featured an image of the castle with the inscription Christiansborg. However, the European colonial rule was not without opposition, and I want to highlight one spectacular case which, in my opinion, could make for a really cool Hollywood movie. In 1693, a group of Akwamu men under their leader Azamani entered the castle disguised as merchants who wished to purchase ammunition. They managed to overpower the occupants of the castle and gained possession of Christiansborg. Asamani took down the Danish flag and gave himself the title of governor. 1 year later, he sold the castle back to the Danes, but never returned the old keys to the castle, and to this day, they apparently are in the possession of the Akuamu people. However, the horrific slave trade continued for another century, until the abolishment of slavery in Denmark in 1792, or rather, the actual enforcement of the abolishment in 1803. Afterwards, the castle lost much of its importance, and in 1850, Christiansborg and all other Danish possessions on the west coast of Africa were sold to the British government. But the suffering of the local population was not over. When they protested new British taxes, the latter responded by shelling the Osu settlement close to the castle with cannon fire. Furthermore, as a security measure, the local population was prohibited from rebuilding their houses. And this ban has been upheld until recently. First, because Christiansborg served as the headquarters of the British colonial state, and then, until 2013, the castle was the seat of the Ghanaian government. As a result, the area encompassing Old Osu has remained largely undisturbed since the mid-1850s. However, after the Ghanaian president moved out of Christiansborg Castle, the ban on constructing buildings in the vicinity of the castle has recently been lifted. And the government approved a large touristic development project, which includes hotels, shopping malls, and casinos. These constructions will directly impact the hidden archaeological and historical heritage from both the pre-colonial and the Danish-Norwegian periods at Osu. I hope this short overview demonstrates that while much of the history of this castle appears clear through historical and ethnographic sources, less is known about the structures and material culture, especially of the role and relation with the adjacent Osu settlement of the local population next to the castle. However, recent archaeological and geophysical investigations increase the knowledge about historical Osu, as in 2014 the Christiansborg Historical Heritage Project was given permission to begin surveys at the site. They have excavated parts of an extensive pre-colonial settlement consisting of house formations and fireplaces. In addition, they have found a large amount of local and imported objects, like Chinese and European ceramics, alongside local pottery, as well as African and European clay smoking pipes. But for me, highlights have to be a cannon they found, which must have fallen from the castle wall, and apparently they even discovered the entrance to an underground tunnel under the castle. As my guest of this episode informed me, this tunnel connected Christiansborg Castle to the Richter House. Built in 1809, this house is located a few meters north of the castle and served as an auction and slave holding facility. The house is named after a wealthy Danish merchant who lived in Osu and generated immense wealth selling African slaves to Danish-Norwegian traders and shippers of the Guinea Company in the early phase of the transatlantic trade era. These are all very exciting discoveries, and I am happy to talk about them and more aspects of archaeology in Ghana with my guest, Dr. Fritz Beveridge, Associate Professor at the Department of Archaeology and Heritage Studies of the University of Ghana. Okay, dear Professor Beveridge, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me. And maybe first, as I'm not familiar with it at all, I wanted to ask you how archaeology and maybe excavations in general are organized in Ghana.
Well, in Ghana, much of the excavations that are undertaken are organized by my unit, which is the Department of Archaeology and Heritage Studies. And then the second one, another institution that does excavations is the Ghana Museums and Monuments Board. Mm-hmm. They are the institution set up by government to maintain heritage sites in Ghana, the monuments and other heritage sites in Ghana. Yeah, so these are the two main institutions. But by far, we are the most active. We do most of the excavations in Ghana. We go to the field more than any other institution.
Yeah.
Yeah. So basically, we are the leading units in Ghana. When I say unit, you know, a university is made up of many units.
Yeah.
One is the Department of Archaeology and Heritage Studies. We are at the forefront of our excavations in Ghana.
That's throughout all of Ghana or more centered on the coast?
No, all of Ghana.
Ah, okay.
Incidentally, we are the only university in Ghana that has an archaeology department.
Ah, okay, yes.
So what happens is that everything comes back to us. We have to do all the excavations, yes. Occasionally, some of the mining companies, as part of their mandate, you know, mining is destructive. It destroys the soil, I mean, the archaeological site. So occasionally, some of these mining companies engage us also to do excavations on their behalf. It's part of their cultural assessment policy. We don't just want to destroy sites, but we want to recover all data before the site is finally mined to recover gold or manganese or whatever. So occasionally, they also give us contracts to excavate on their behalf. They fund everything. Yes.
I was wondering how the financing part works. If the state is paying, but you say also the companies have to pay. Yeah.
In Ghana, the state doesn't pay. The state, most of the funding comes from private institutions. And then from the university itself. As part of our budget for the year, we have some funding allocated for excavations.
Yep.
So that is what we use. But the government hardly funds archaeological excavations in Ghana. And then in the past, we used to have some partners also, like NORPART, the Norwegian group, in collaboration with them. And occasionally, they'll also come here and we work together as a team on some of these sites.
That's what I wanted to ask, because I have to mention I studied parts of my master also in Trondheim in Norway, and that's how I got to know the interesting research activities taking place in Ghana, also around the Christiansborg Castle. And I was wondering, in your view, how has this collaboration with Norwegian researchers and universities benefited archaeologists in Ghana, but more importantly, also vice versa? How have the European archaeologists benefited from your expertise and experiences?
Well, the collaboration has been very beneficial for us. Number one, as part of the collaboration, they allow us to send about 5 graduate students to Norway, to Trondheim, every year. And they stay in Trondheim at the University of Science and Technology, something like that.
Yeah, and continue, yes.
Yes, yes. And they stay there for like the master's, the MBA students spend about a month, and then the MPhil and the PhD spend like 4 months or 3 months or something. And then they use the laboratory over there and then to analyze some of their materials, especially radiocarbon dating.
Mm-hmm.
So they do that there. And we are not very good when it comes to Stone Age materials. So Trondheim has much of that over there. So the collaboration is very beneficial for our students. In terms of faculty, some of them also come here and we work together as a team. And then the third very important benefit we get from this collaboration is that much of the time when they come and they are going, they give us the tools which they brought, like a drone, GPS, and a few things that they brought. They leave it for us. So in a way, it enhances our work here. It gives us the technical know-how. It gives us the material, the tools to do modern archaeology. So it's been very beneficial. Unfortunately, the collaboration has ended. Mm. It wasn't renewed by the Norwegian government. It ended about 2 years ago. We tried to revive it by doing a second phase, but the Norwegian government was not too keen on it said it had other areas that it wanted to sponsor, so it didn't come on. But we have a few other collaborations with other universities, and most of them are in the UK. So in terms of collaboration, it's been very beneficial. For the Europeans, one thing that helps them is that they're not too familiar with the environment here. They're not too familiar with the sites and the materials which are available. So we also share that knowledge with them. Mm-hmm. In an area like iron smelting, we have all the information. So if an European scholar, for example, wants to do something about iron smelting, we impart that knowledge to them. And the pottery here is very different from the pottery in Europe. Yes, we have all the classification schemes here, which we use. So we are familiar with different pottery from different sites. So we impart this kind of knowledge to them. When it comes to ethnomedicine, for example, we've done so much here. So any European who is interested in ethnomedicine, data is already available. So that's a good thing about them. It's been beneficial to both sides, I would say that. I wish we could revive some of these, especially with the Norwegians. They were very good. Yes, they were very good.
You mentioned before that also mining companies, sometimes they pay for the excavations.
Yes.
Is that like by law that they have to pay if they mine an area that there is cultural heritage and they will destroy, that they have to pay for excavations taking place? Or
Yes, it's part of their contract. One company that is at the forefront of this is a company called Newmont. It's a big mining company. They have a very big concession in Ashanti region. Mm-hmm. And the site has a lot of shrines, a lot of late Stone Age sites, and some contemporary sites also, which have been vacated in the last 100 years or so. So what they do is that they work with faculty members who go and conduct excavations, recover these materials, and write very extensive reports of their finds before the site is destroyed. They never destroy the site before the excavation. The excavations are always done before.
That's very good. That's very good to hear. Yeah. It's better
There are other companies too, not necessarily in mining, but there are some companies too, like those involved in energy. These are mostly foreign companies that come into the country to build plants and other things. Some of them also engage faculty. I remember in the early 2000s, I was engaged in one of these. There was a company called the West Africa Gas Pipeline, and they wanted to build a plant at Tema. And I went to work on the site and recovered everything before the site was finally destroyed. So some of these companies are also, but they are foreign companies, and it's part of their contract that before they start, cultural assessment study has to be done before they start digging. So they have a small percentage of money which is supposed to be used for this. Yes, it's very important. Yeah.
So they have to announce that they will. Mine in this area, and then one of your faculty goes and checks if it's something.
Yeah, sometimes the sites are the area is very big, so it involves 3-4 faculty at the same time working at different locations.
Oh, that's great. So then also the students have a lot of opportunities to work and excavate on different regions and time periods.
Yes, they do. Currently, one of our students. One of our master's students, for example, there's supposed to be an expansion of the Tamale Airport. So some faculty went and did a cultural assessment study. Mm-hmm. And we're able to map areas which were important archaeological sites. And some of the materials were very covered. And then there's another company coming to set up solar panels across a very wide area. So currently one of our master's students is working in that area. He's also documenting the GPS locations of some of these sites before the company comes in to destroy the site. Yes, you know, in the process of building, they are going to destroy the site.
I know. Well, so there are never like any conflicts, because I know from I'm also working on excavation right now, and we have a bit of conflict with the construction company because they want to construct and we have to excavate. So they push that we excavate faster. So there are no like conflicts like this taking place sometimes with the mining companies.
Yes. Yes. It's very common here. They always want to work very quickly, and archaeology is something that you can't just go and, you know, it has to be done in a certain way, scientifically. So it's the same here. Just like you are experiencing, we also have the same problem here. They come and they say, I want this thing done in a month. Mm-hmm. But technically, it can't be done in a month. And they're always on you to finish quickly so that they can come in and start mining for gold and other minerals. So it's a common thing here also, yeah.
For archaeologists worldwide, maybe that's the thing, yeah.
Yeah.
And the excavations are done by the faculty and students, or is there like a profession as field archaeologists?
No, it's done by faculty. Yeah, it's done by faculty. Of course, we recruit the students to help us because we need to pass the technical know-how to them. Mm-hmm. They need to know how excavations are done, the scientific way. So we always take them to the fields to be part of these excavations. And in the process, they learn how to conduct proper excavations, scientific excavations, yes. So, yes, it's mostly faculty and students. In Ghana, we don't have many professional archaeologists who are into excavations, no. And the reason for that is that archaeology is a growing profession in Ghana. It's not as well established as it is in Norway or Denmark or America or any other place. Mm-hmm. It's a growing science. Yeah, so as we speak now, many of the professionals in archaeology are mostly faculty members. They are not professional archaeologists who can undertake excavations like it is in the US, where they have companies. So that is it. It's mostly faculty and students who do. Yeah.
I read this excavations now around Christiansborg. They happen because they want to build, I think, a tourist resort or hotels or something.
Yeah, but the area west of Christiansborg Castle, mm-hmm, it's also been planned to be used as a kind of tourist center, hotels, and a lot of leisure activities. One faculty member went there to do salvage archaeology to recover some materials before the site would be totally destroyed. And then, fortunately, we also had one lady, a PhD student, who was also part of that team, and she used the site as a research area for her PhD. Mm-hmm. So we were able to recover a lot of materials, not as much as we would want to, because the site is huge. And we were only able to do a little part. And that was because of financial constraints. You know, archaeology is very expensive. It's one of the most expensive social sciences. We need a lot of money to be able to conduct very good excavation. So we're not able to do that, but we're able to, the area west of Christiansborg Castle was excavated. And we have many of the materials currently in our museum. Mm-hmm. They've been documented by the faculty member and one lady who did a PhD. So we have some material, not as much as we would want, but we have some material.
Maybe if I can ask you, I read that for example, during the excavations now around Christiansborg Castle, that they also discovered like an underground tunnel and cannons and one cannon, I think, that fell down from the castle wall. Do you know more about this underground tunnel where it leads to?
Yes, it's still there. It's closed now. I've not accessed it. Mm-hmm. But it was used to transfer slaves from the dungeons to slave ships, which were berthed ashore. You know, we didn't have a harbor, so they had to stay way back. And then canoes would take them to the ships.
Oh, yeah.
And as a security concern, it was easier to transfer through these tunnels. It's currently closed anyway. I'm yet to. I think the main reason why they closed it is that it's not physically strong enough. They don't want it to collapse, or they don't want anybody to go in. Yes, mm-hmm. That's the main reason why. But the cannons are many. Some of them are still standing. Not just cannons, but cannonballs also.
Yeah.
Which were fired from the cannons. They are also standing.
I read that the British, when they took over the castle, they also shelled the Osu settlement when they protested.
Yes, they did. Yeah. There was this conflict between the two, groups. Much of it bordered on trade, and the British bombarded the place. In fact, the British were not the only people to bombard coastal sites in Ghana. They did the same in Winneba. There was a fort in Winneba and they blew it up. And then there was another one in Disco, where I've been working for the past 5 years or so. But in that day, they also bombarded the town. And then Elimina, let's not forget Elimina also. Elimina was bombarded. Elimina old town was also bombarded. But that was by the Dutch, not by the English. Yeah, so... It's not a new thing. Bombardment is not an easy thing. And it mostly arose because of conflicts between the local people and European traders.
You conducted a lot of research, not only on this Danish-Norwegian castles, but also British or Dutch colonial forts in Ghana, I read.
Yes.
And I was wondering what material... culture evidence do we have for contacts between the local population and these European occupants in these forts, or maybe even evidence of intermixing of these two peoples?
Oh yeah, there's a lot of evidence. I will divide that into two: the tangibles and the intangibles. When it comes to the tangibles, we have a lot of European imports from the 16th century right up to the 19th century in the archaeological records. Some of them include kaolin smoking pipes. These were imported from Poland. And then we had ceramics, different types of ceramics. Some are coming as far back as way back as from Japan and China.
Okay.
The Dutch were kind of moving around and buying and coming to resell on the Guinea coast. So we have different types of ceramics, porcelain, white wares, blue wares, and so many of them. And then we also have a lot of Bohemian and Venetian glass beads. These were an integral part of imports from Europe. Mm-hmm. In polychrome and in monochromes, they are all several. We get them in hundreds at different sites. Then we also have construction materials like nails, like screws, like door locks, window panes, glass window panes. And then another very important material we get in very large quantities is European alcoholic beverages.
Oh,
yeah. A lot of sherbet bottles, a lot of whiskey, beer. Mineral bottle in thousands. We get them in all of these sites. Many of the excavations I've done at several sites is about 20% of what I get. It's quite significant. And then we also have a lot of imported metal products from Europe, like cutlasses, axes, mattocks. These were integral to facilitation of the co-star trade. So we also get these in abundance. We have metal buttons for clothes. Mm-hmm. You know, that because they were made of metal, so they don't disintegrate in the archaeological record. We also have a lot of belt hooks. The leather is gone, but the belt hooks, because it's metal, is still in the archaeological record. We have asbestos roofing sheets. All these were brought in. Yellow bricks, red bricks, yellow bricks from Holland, red bricks from Portugal. So many materials. When it comes to the intangibles, there were a lot of intermarriages between occupants of Christiansborg Castle and the local Ghana people who lived around the fort. And one good example is the wolf, that important trader who married a Usu woman and had children. There are several mulatto families in Usu now with a Danish and a Norwegian names, like Ishlika. So many names. The names has passed on from generation to generation. And then when it comes to architecture, many of the buildings in Usu now, they have a Norwegian, Danish architecture styles. And then when it comes to education, the Danes and the Norwegians who were active in the Christiansborg area, they also had they built several schools. One that is still standing is Salem. There's a school called Salem. It's more than 300 years old. It's still standing. There's so much. There is so much. The evidence is abundantly clear.
Maybe as a final question, almost. It was interesting for me to read that another colonial fort related to this transatlantic slave trade, the Cape Coast Castle, I think some 150 kilometers west of Christiansborg, was visited by Obama in 2008, and also by Melania Trump in 2018. Could you maybe elaborate on how you and the other archaeologists, or just the local population, experienced these visits?
It was a big event in Ghana, especially when the two events were very big in Ghana. But I would want to state that archaeologists were not part of anything that was done there. It was a purely government-to-government thing. So archaeologists had nothing to do with it. We were not involved in the planning. We were not involved in organizing anything. Yes, these two very important people visited those castles, but they were taken around by tour guides who are employees of the Ghana Museums and Monuments Board. We just saw everything on TV, but we were not part of anything to do with it. Yes.
Yeah, okay. So these were very interesting insights. Thank you so much, Professor Beveridge. And I hope that it will continue, the collaboration with the Norwegians?
I hope so. It was very, very beneficial.
And thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me.
You're welcome. Anytime you need some information, you can always call me.
Okay, I will. Thank you so much.
All right. That's it for this episode. I wanted to cover this topic since many years, and it was really interesting for me to read and hear more about archaeology in Ghana. Thanks again to Professor Fritz Beveridge for these interesting insights. So, if you enjoyed it as well, please follow and subscribe to this podcast, and you can even support it over on Patreon. I hope you will tune in about 2 weeks for another edition of Archaeological Context with Dr. Noah.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.